Just as a way of reminding you of our discussion last week, when we began our discussion of Paul as the persecuted persecutor, we mentioned that the letter of Philippians, and we basically centered our study in Philippians chapter 1, shows an individual who was indeed in the midst of privation. He was being persecuted for his faith. He had been arrested, and it was his appeal to Caesar as a Roman citizen that led to his imprisonment, his house arrest in the city of Rome. It had become evident, verse 13 states this of chapter 1, to the whole palace guard and to all the rest, that the reason why he was in chains was because of his ministry, because of Christ. He was an apostle of Christ. It was because he was preaching the gospel of Christ that he got into the trouble that he got into. So this was the circumstance, the situation he found himself in. But as we mentioned in our study last week, the letter that Paul wrote to the Philippians was not a letter that indicates discouragement in any way or sadness, but rather it is a letter of joy. And specifically, it was written to thank the Philippians for the gift that they had sent by the hand of Epaphroditus, a brother that the apostle counted dear, who suffered himself in his travels to come and to bear the gift that the Philippians had sent to Paul in Jerusalem. And so there was much to rejoice about despite the persecution that he was suffering. This is, I think, the primary lesson that we're trying to establish here in this particular outline. The fact that despite our suffering, and we indeed can suffer greatly as a result of our faith in Christ, we can suffer greatly simply as a matter of course as we live on this earth, because this is a temporary abode. We are in mortal bodies, and it is the lot of some to suffer more than others, but each and every one of us have our measure of suffering in life, just as a matter of course, from the time that we live or born and until the time that we die. But despite the difficulties of life, there are reasons for us to rejoice. There is happiness that we can have, of course, as a result of the relationships that we have while we are here. But the primary point here is that Paul's mindset, his joy, was as a result of his perspective. And his perspective was focused, a perspective that understood that this life is not what our existence is all about, but rather the life that is to come. I would remind you of the text beginning in verse 22 of Philippians 1, where Paul said, "If I live on in the flesh, this will mean fruit for my labor. Yet what I shall choose I cannot tell, for I am hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. And being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy of faith, that your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ by my coming to you again." The Apostle Paul was not being selfish. He understood how that to leave this life, that is, in effect, to die and to go on to eternity, is something that was preferable. He had an understanding of what came after the grave. He had that trust, as he related in 2 Timothy, the 4th chapter, that because of his faithfulness, there was a crown of righteousness that was laid up for him. And that was a reason for him to rejoice. He was very happy despite how difficult his life was at that point in time. But he didn't know whether it was that he would be put to death as a result of his faith, or whether he would be released from prison and be able to minister to them. Both things were positive for him. He was just awaiting whatever decision would come. But it would be a good thing, in fact, as he expresses here, a better thing, if he were to leave this life and go on to the next. And that's an attitude that we all have. Now, we're going to go into the applications in just a moment, but there's one thing we didn't really emphasize greatly last week that I do want to just touch upon again. We did point out the fact that this isn't an indication it is wrong for us to desire to continue to live. For example, for those of our number tonight who are young, especially, you want to live a long life. You want to experience what this life has to offer. You want to get married and have children and have grandchildren and to live a good and long life. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It is simply important that you remain focused on eternity and be mindful of the thing, of the fact that once this life is over, that then the next life will be even better than the joy that you have experienced in your time if you lived upon the earth. Having said that, there's a flip side to that. There are some some who are Christians who have reached that stage in their life to where they long for that next life. Couldn't come too quickly for them. And it's not, again, as we talked about last week, that they desire to be unclothed. I think Dennis brought this up, but rather the desire is to be further clothed. And the recognition of the frailness of the body, the recognition of the loss of loved ones. I'll just give as an example. We've had a couple of funerals here that we have attended, members here at Westside, those of our number who have passed away, those who were of our number and have moved away that came back to be buried. And one of the things that is interesting to me whenever I see funerals is that the longer an individual lives, the sparser the attendance is to their funeral. Now, that's not a hard and fast rule. I mean, you have people who are famous or something along those lines, and they may have lots and lots of people or people who have some influence. But generally, the longer you live, you begin outliving individuals. And you may outlive your spouse, and you may outlive some of your children, and you may outlive your friends. And there is that tendency as you get older and older that maybe you can become and feel more isolated as a result of the circumstances in life. And so in that state or situation, it is not a surprising thing that your mind would turn more quickly and more often to the promised joy and the promised comfort and the promised rest and the promised immortal body that you read about in Scripture, because you get tired and because life is difficult. And so it can be the point where you reach that. And again, it's not a death wish by any means, but rather a willingness to say, okay, I'm ready. I've lived my life. I've had my time here on this earth. I'm ready for something that is better. And I'm looking forward to that. And some brethren can actually feel that way and desire that, but almost feel a little bit guilty that they're wanting to get on to the next stage. And questions arise as to the appropriateness of that. I think that's exactly what the Apostle Paul was feeling at this time. That very, very thought that I'm ready to go on to the next stage. Now, I realize I've got things left to do here. I'm fine with staying. In fact, I recognize that staying is going to be beneficial to my brethren. But I'm ready to go on. And I've had enough of this life, and I'm ready for the next. And that's there's nothing wrong with having that attitude at all. In both cases, whether it's an individual who says, I'm not ready to go yet, but I am looking forward to it, or else the individual who says, well, I've had enough of this and I'm ready for the next, the focus needs to be upon what is to come. And as we contemplate what is to come, and as we read the numerous comparisons that are found in Scripture, 1 Corinthians 15 gives a wonderful example of this, where you talk about the mortal body. The mortal must put on immortality. The corruptible must put on incorruption. The change that will happen in a moment in the twinkling of an eye. This is a glorious thing to look forward to. And as we continue that focus on those things, and that hope that we have, the promise that we have in eternity, it can help us to be greatly encouraged. Brantley last week, he had some to say about how impressed he was with the mindset of Paul in this particular passage. And it is indeed something that is impressive to recognize that in the midst of all of this suffering, the difficulties that he had, that he was so joyous, and the fact that though there were difficulties in his life, he did not perceive it as a difficult life because of the good and the hope and the positives that were present. And that's the mindset that we need to have. And of course, that's kind of what we're trying to go with these particular lessons as we talk about victory in Jesus. Paul's a wonderful example of this. Look at where he was, and yet look at how he treated that circumstance, how he felt about his life and his circumstances, and seek to emulate that. And it takes maturity, but it also is a mindset that we can strive to attain. And as we are more and more successful in that, we can have more and more joy while we live here on this earth, despite the difficult circumstances we find ourselves in. Okay, so we've kind of discussed Philippians chapter 1 and Paul's attitude, and we do this not with every single lesson, but basically as we look at these lessons, we can make some applications. We can bring in some other passages which establish these truths, and that's what we want to do here. So the first passage I would like you to turn to is in Romans, the 12th chapter, if you will. I want to remind you of the fact that one of Paul's reasons for rejoicing, though he was in prison, is because of the fact that his brethren had helped him. And, of course, there were two aspects to that. He rejoiced because of what he received. He rejoiced to an even greater extent because of the blessings that they received by being benevolent toward him. In other words, he received physical help. They received spiritual blessings as a result of their ministrations to him. And so this is a good point that we can make, is the ministration of our brethren can help us during difficult times. Now, there are two sides to this, but keep in mind our focus is how is it that I can have a victorious life as I live for Jesus. So I want you to look at it from my point of view, or your point of view individually, as you're suffering difficulties in life. We do want to emphasize the importance of each and every one of us to be mindful of the problems our brethren have. When others are suffering, we need to be mindful of the fact that our brethren are suffering and strive to do what we can to help them. So we need to be mindful of those things so we can offer that help. But as we look at it from our point of view, I'm suffering right now. It is a true encouragement to me. It is a true joy to me that in the midst of my suffering, that my brethren love me and they care for me and they express such care and concern. Now, if you look at Romans chapter 12 and verses 15 and 16 of the text, these instructions are given to rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. And do not be wise in your own opinion. Now, the primary aspect of this is, I think, verse 15. Perhaps some of this idea of being of the same mind. As Christians, we need to think about others as we would wish for others to think about us and consider us in our difficulties and our needs. Whenever we're suffering and have a need, we want our brethren to help us through those things. So we need to be mindful, be of the same mind, thinking about our brother as they would think about us, and strive to do that. But this idea of rejoicing with those who rejoice and weeping with those who weep, there is a great deal of comfort that comes from a brother or sister in Christ during difficult times, having their brethren come to them, and it may be simply to sit there and to weep with them, simply to have that shoulder to cry on, to have those words murmured, and really, this is something that I found as a preacher, because believe me, it is very, very difficult. Whenever I'm preaching a funeral, it's very, very difficult for me to know what to say. And words are helpful. And sometimes it's not so much what we are saying, but the fact that we are there and we are saying it that is of the greatest comfort. Now, you know, I'm real careful when I preach at a funeral that I'm going to write down exactly what I'm going to say. While my notes may be fairly sparse when I'm preaching a sermon, when I'm doing a funeral, I've always been of a mindset to almost write that out word by word, because I don't want to misspeak. I don't want to say something awkward or something inappropriate. So I'm very careful about that. But the fact is, let's just take that as an example. If someone is mourning the loss of a loved one, and you go to their home and you sit down with them and you talk to them and you're there and you express your sorrow with them and you cry with them, it may be they will not remember a single thing that you said during that time, because in such times of emotional upheaval, often that is the case. It's hard to remember as the days go by, but they do remember you being there. And they do remember those kind expressions and those sympathies. Even if they don't know what you said, they remember that you were there and you said something. And that can be such an encouragement and such a help during difficult times. So the Apostle Paul was very much encouraged because the Philippians had helped him. And we can certainly be an encouragement to others in the very same way. And you need, if you're in that situation, to reach out. Sometimes we have that tendency to isolate ourselves and be miserable rather than allowing individuals to help us through it. So if you can just reach out a bit and allow your brethren to help you, it can be something that's truly encouraging. Yes, sir.
What you were talking about, I had a discussion with a former member that used to be here a long time ago, and they lost a son. And we were talking about the situation, what took place after that. And in fact, his wife was coming after the son had lost it. And one of her problems was people would come tell her that, "I know how you feel." And they had never lost a son. And she didn't think they knew how she felt. And she resented it. And she resented it to a point. Now, all I'm saying is what you said about be careful what you say.
Yeah.
But all you got to do is say, "I'm sorry." You know. And like you said, as long as you're there, but don't say, "I know how you feel," if you haven't been through what they've been through.
Kind of an interesting thing. This is something that it's very much stereotypical. In fact, I can say it's stereotypical because it's not true in my marriage. But you hear where between the difference between men and women with regard to things is that a woman may complain to her husband about some particular thing, and what the husband wants to do is fix it, where what the wife actually wants is just to say, "Oh, I'm sorry," and to commiserate and to show such sympathy, and so she's willing to offer that, when what the man wants, when he's got the problem, he wants someone to tell him what to do to fix it. It's a little bit stereotypical, because it seems like whenever I have a complaint, my wife tells me how to fix it. So Debbie's kind of that way. I think that's kind of funny. I think it's more about how her family is. The Lisenbys are good at telling you how to fix things, and so that's kind of a part of her family upbringing. But that's the point, is that what we're talking about here with regard to these expressions of sympathies. And by the way, In the Paul's letter to the Philippians, it wasn't necessarily the expression of sympathies. He was in prison. They were sending him food and sending him clothes and things that were needful. So it was actually doing for. But we're not talking in these kinds of things about fixing it or to try to explain why things are as they are, but simply weeping with them. That's what that text there in Romans 12 indicates. To weep with those who weep, rejoice with those who rejoice. And what Jerry indicated is, I mean, true. It's simply saying, "I'm sorry." Not necessarily, "I know how you feel," or to begin describing bad things that happen in your life. But just say, "I know that you're hurting, and I'm sorry that you're hurting, and you're in our prayers, and we love you." And that's enough. And it's not magic words. It's just the acknowledgement that it's a difficult time, and because you're hurting, we're hurting with you. And that can be extremely beneficial and helpful. Yes, please.
I just want to mention Job, because because it reminded me of his three friends. Probably the best work they did was before they even opened their mouth. And they came and sat with him for 7 days and 7 nights without speaking a single word.
If they could have just kept it there.
It
would have been good, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it was when Job's friends began talking and trying to explain to him why he was in the state he was in that it became somewhat difficult for Job. But I'm sure he appreciated the fact that they were there with him. Yes, Josh?
Hearing the discussion, it has been interesting. Tuning to the men on both sides again. It's kind of funny that Dennis brings up Job because I had my Bible open to Job right now, considering that. But, we're supposed to give properly. Jerry mentioned this. If we give a sentiment verbally, we need to give it properly. More appropriately. But there's a side to this that if you're receiving, look at Paul. He received appropriately. He understood. Even if they sent me two cloaks and no tunic, you know, well, didn't they know I needed a tunic? You know, or they sent me all bread, but didn't they know that I needed some meat in my diet or whatnot. Take the gift. Take it well. Easy to have your feelings hurt in all sorts of small ways when you're hurting.
Yeah, that's kind of a tough thing to discuss, especially if you're in the midst of difficulties right now, because you don't want to cast dispersion upon the individual who's hurting at all. But we have tried to point this out on occasion, so we'll just very, very concisely state this, is that, you know, one of the reasons why the Apostle Paul was able to handle what he went through was because of his approach to it, his personal mindset, his maturity. As Jerry indicated, you've got to be careful with what you say. But with some people, no matter what you say, they're not going to take it well. And so sometimes the onus in regard to that as to why they're resentful might be theirs rather than anything that was said that was harmful or inappropriate. And especially when good intentions are being expressed. Whereas if you have that ability and you're sufficiently spiritually mature, spiritual minded, that when individuals make an effort and they're expressing that empathy and they're striving to help, that even if they don't say it exactly right or if something isn't exactly what you need, the very fact that they are striving and they care for you and they're expressing that concern, that can be enough to be an encouragement to you if you have that proper mindset. And since that's basically what this particular entire series is about, is how do we approach it when we're hurting, I think it's a good admonition to say, you know, try your very best when you're hurting and someone comes up to you to try to help, even if they're awkward in it, even if they're not doing a very good job of it, to look beyond that to what's in their heart and the very fact that they're there and they're making that effort is an indication that they truly do care for you, that they are seeking to do, as Paul said in Romans 12, to weep with you while you're weeping. And that in and of itself can be something that can be an encouragement if you have that ability to address it in that way and to allow yourself to be encouraged. Not easy, by any means. We're not talking about something that's easy in regard to this, but it's something that is possible and something that is being seen by Paul, especially in this case. Fred, Jason.
Help people out too. If you've got something going on, let people know. You know, we're not mind readers, and yet we can observe and see, and some events are going to be more outward, but if they're struggling with something, you know, be it privately or publicly, whatever the situation calls for, ask for help, or let it be known.
hard to know if you're not told or if you're not aware.
When I went down to see Abby, weekend before last, was talking to the preacher there. He said, "You know, she was sick. And she'd been, you know, running people for 14 days. Well, and didn't anybody know either. You know, some of the girls knew, but, you know, and that's one of the difficulties that we have as elders sometimes. We don't always know what's going on. Other people find out maybe sometimes before we do. Let somebody know what's going on in your life before it's gone on way too long and some of the problems are irreparable.
Let's yes, go ahead.
I'd be interested in to hear what other people say about this right here. We're hitting it up a lot on being the one and going helping somebody. And I think a lot of times people have a hard time being the help instead of being the helper. And possibly women have more of a problem with that because we're more nurturing than most men. Not to say men aren't, but you know, women tend to be that much more nurturing than men. How has people, or have people overcome that feeling of, I don't want to be needy, I don't want to be perceived as being overly needy when I'm needing problems, or I'm needing help, or I'm having health issues? Sure, you can say, if I don't tell people, I'm not giving them their Christian obligation to reach out to me. But that's still a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah. Okay, there's one suggestion I've got, or one observation I have in that regard, and then I'll open it up. What she was asking is if some of you who have had that hesitance to let people in and let people help you, and you're willing to help others on drop a hat, but you don't want to be a burden, and you've had that hesitancy, and you've been able to overcome it, how did you manage to overcome it to allow people to be more helpful to you during the difficulty? So be thinking about that for a moment. One observation that I want to bring out in this regard is whenever these difficulties happen in our lives, we have a tendency, and this is appropriate, number one, but it's also very natural, to turn to our biological families. When you think about that, I want you to think about the fact that you'll turn to your mother or your father, you'll turn to your sister or your brother, or your children during these difficulties. It's natural for you to reach out to them. Why? Because of the relationship that you've developed over a number of years. It's a very close relationship. You've heard, blood is thicker than water, that kind of thing. And so whenever the difficult times come, families come together as a result of that. And there's that appeal. So if you want to feel like you can express your needs to your brethren, the closer that you are to them, the more you feel about them as a family, the more involved you are as a member of the congregation, not just with regard to coming every time to worship, but in Acts the second chapter, you'll remember that the disciples were daily with one another, and they were involved in each other's lives, and they had developed relationships, and there was a closeness and a kinship that was there to where it was a natural thing. And I think especially in our society, Western society, our culture, our jobs, our houses. I just read just a couple of days ago the claims made, and I think it's somewhat a secular view of things, but how that the nuclear family, not so much husband, wife, mother, and father, but just a single family unit in a single home instead of a larger family together, like grandparents and great-grandparents and everybody living together. That's something actually a fairly relative, fairly recent as a result of the fact that we've become a bit more prosperous as a nation. But as a result of that, you have situations where, okay, you've got this family, and the kids go away, now you've got an empty nest, and the spouse dies, and now you're by yourself. Whereas in generations past, there were still people around because everybody was still together. And so there is that loneliness there. And I think the same thing can happen in the church. We live far apart. We have our lives that we involve ourselves in, and our involvement with the people of God comes two or three times a week for an hour at a time. And most of the time then, we're sitting in our pews staring straight ahead listening to the preacher. And so the more you can become acquainted with, close to, involved with your brethren, when the difficult time comes, the more likely you are to reach out to them and say, I need help. Instead of saying, I don't want to be an imposition, brethren, I need you right now. And I think part of it has to do with that relationship. And sometimes it's lacking in churches. And that's one of the reasons why we need, whenever newcomers come around, to embrace them. Because they don't feel that yet. We need to make them feel welcome and a part of the family. And that lies upon us. So with regard to anybody else have any suggestions or thoughts in that regard? Yes, Justin.
There are different ways that people express and more easily accept the expression of love. And some psychologists coined the phrase love languages, but some of them, some kids will be more responsive to being told that they did a good job, whereas another kid might be more responsive to having a hug after they did a good job. Unless one of them had words of affirmation as the way that they loved and the way that they received love, and then another in touch. And one of them is service. And so there's a group of people where the easiest way they know to express love is to serve. And the easiest way they know to receive love is to serve. And that's kind of my thing. We'll just take me, for example, where I'm not a big fan of being touched, but some people's love language is touch. And so it's irresponsible of me to not let them touch me, because I'm not letting them express their love towards me. Well, in the same way, somebody like myself, or like Jonathan Hines, whose love language is service. And Jonathan loved to serve, because serving was what made him feel good, and it was the most natural way for him to express love. And so he would offer to help all the time. He'd normally get turned down. And it might just be little things or whatever. Hey, you want me to come help mow your lawn or something like that, right? He would gladly mow everyone's lawn in the congregation. and he would try to seek out people that he thought might be more needy than her, right? Like he might have gone to widows or a husband's working a bunch of hours and mom's home with four kids or something. He'd try to seek out people that were more needy than him, but he still normally got turned out. And it seems like the turning down of a lot of these little things like that, it's like, well, I don't want to mow your yard. Well, I have a problem with that, because I'm very particular about my things. I don't want you messing with my yard. I'll go mow my yard. Justin, you haven't mowed your yard in 4 months. I'll be around for it. But I don't want you mowing my yard. And I was really impressed with Travis Calvert overcoming that, because, and it wasn't even him necessarily seeking out help. It was that he saw that Phil Simpson's love language was service. And so he hired Phil Simpson to come and do things on his property. And Phil often didn't do them exactly how Travis wanted them done. But Travis recognized the sacrifice he could make in not having things just how he wanted them, to let Phil serve him. Even though it's being paid, it's still serving him.
Right.
And that was good for Phil. And a lot of times we want to be self-sufficient, and we don't want people serving us. And then we get to
And in a situation like that, it allows you to because you're not in a circumstance of duress and in difficulties, to say that I'm not being in an imposition, I'm allowing someone to express, you know, and I put it this way, getting stars in your crown. I'm letting another person get started. And that's something that, as a preacher, I've really had a hard time with. But as a preacher, you've got to let people do for you. When you go off in gospel meetings, other kinds of things, people want to do for you. And say, I want to pay for this meal. And you say, no. But now I say, okay, thank you. You know, I appreciate it. And please don't think that the preacher is being a moocher. He just recognized, okay, this is something that's Lord's going to appreciate them for what they've done for the preacher. And I'm going to let them do it. And I have to grit my teeth sometimes, because I can pay for my own meal, and I kind of wanted to pay for theirs, but I'm going to let them pay for mine. And so that's kind of the way that we're talking about here. If you can get that mindset during the easy times, that when people are doing for you, you're not imposing, you're allowing them to put some stars on their crown. Then when the difficult times come and you really need that help, you're going to be less likely to feel like you're in imposition and imposing. So that's a good point. Yes.
One of the things I found worked out with your kids on my thing, start with small kids, they love to have stitching. And it's easier once you start with the smaller kids, graduate to other people. And it's easier to work that way. You start small with kids, they all love stitching.
And that might be something to tell the parents too, to instill in your children a willingness to receive help. Not an expectation. There's a big difference between willingness and expectation. But if someone wants to do something nice for you, be gracious and say thank you instead of not letting them. And that helps us all be good Christians and do what we're supposed to do. Okay, we're not going very fast, and we're going to be here in another year and a half in these if we don't continue on. So I want to get through the last three points. We may not have a chance to get through the questions, but let's make these points very quickly. First of all, James 1, 2 through 4, if you'll turn there. James 1, 2 through 4. And I want to remind you again of the Apostle Paul in this particular case, that although he was in a difficult situation, two things had happened. Number one, it became obvious to everyone, even the palace guard, that the reason he was suffering was not because he had done anything wrong, but rather because he was an ambassador for Christ. Secondly, it had emboldened his brethren to preach the gospel as they saw his willingness to suffer for the cause. They were emboldened to stand up and be counted as well. And so he could, in effect, look at the silver lining. Yes, I'm suffering, but look at the good that is coming as a result of it. And I would remind you of what is said in James 1, verses 12 through 14 concerning the man who endures temptation. The idea of enduring here is an example of this. He said, when he has been approved, he'll receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he's tempted, I'm tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. I was down in verse 12. Because that point is made there as well, but in verse 2 through 4. Again, going down to verse 12, understand, when you have been approved, you receive the crown of life. Verse 2, it says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. Let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect, complete, lacking in nothing. So both passages teach the same thing. But in verses 2 and 4 more directly, when an individual endures patiently the tribulations of life, it produces in him patience. And so that's a positive thing. And in fact, the statement there is that you need to rejoice. Count it all joy when you fall into these difficult situations, because look what good comes from the difficult situations you find yourself in. And that's an important lesson for us to learn as well. Sometimes it is difficult to find the silver lining, but it's important that we look for that silver lining, and that can help us with regard to our mindset in the midst of the difficulties. We're not going to have time to get to all of them, but let's just very quickly go to the third one. Go, if you will, very quickly to Luke chapter 16. Luke 16. And this is an allusion back to, with regard to Paul, that death was preferable To depart and be with Christ is far better, as he said. And I want you to notice what happened with regard to Lazarus, that beggar that's recorded in Luke chapter 16. You'll notice there in Luke 16, beginning in verse 20, there is described a certain beggar named Lazarus who was full of sores, who was laid at his gate, desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores, and it was that the beggar died. So all that we have explained of Lazarus' life as he lived is that he was a beggar, that he was had sores all over his body, and because of that state, he never had enough to eat. And eventually this just absolutely deplorable state of living ended in his death. Now you'll notice down in verse 25 of the text, when the rich man who had fared sumptuously before his death, he died and was buried, he awoke in torment. And he cried in verse 24, he said, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me. Send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in the flame." Notice Abraham's answer. He said, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, likewise Lazarus, evil things. But now he is comforted and you are tormented." And that's not a matter of if you got good things in the life that you live, you're going to have bad things after your life is over and vice versa. What is basically indicating is that as a result of his relationship with God, because of his righteousness, Lazarus, though he suffered a great deal in the life that he lived, he is comforted now in Abraham's bosom, great gulf fixed between, to where his eternal reward, yet received, is something that would be one of eternal joy and bliss. And again, if you can keep that in mind, if our hope is in heaven, then this life will hold less appeal for us, and the difficulties of this life will be less trying on us, because we know that even if we suffer evil in this life, then the life that is to come will hold for us a great deal of joy and comfort and rest. So Luke 16 is a good example to look at there. We'll pick up with the fourth application, look at the questions next week, and then get into lesson 17. All right? Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention tonight. And the good discussion that we had.